Blood on the Tracks is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis.
John Lennon was a musical genius and one of the most beloved cultural figures of the 20th century. His songs inspired dreamers to imagine. His search for the truth gave power to the people. But some thought he dreamed too much. Others thought he was too powerful. So he was followed. He was threatened. He was declared a danger to the United States. And in 1980, he was assassinated. This is his story, told by his so-called friends.
This is Special Agent Jim Steele with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, working case number 009-08-0491. Case subject is Lennon John Winston Ono. This information pertains to a period ending August 1974. Interview subject is Nixon Richard Milhouse. Interview number 0-80-919-74, December 30th, 1980.
I do not consider myself to be anything but an average person. None of us should, really. Although we all think we're a little smarter than we actually are. To me, the unhappiest people in the world are people on the south coast of France, and Newport, and Palm Springs, and Palm Beach, going to parties every night, playing golf, and then bridge, drinking too much, talking too much, thinking too little, no purpose. I feel that life without purpose, life in which an individual is forced to go against his intuition about what he thinks he ought to do, that's when life becomes almost unbearable. Not having anything to live for can be a shattering experience. It may have looked like John Lennon believed in the courage of his convictions, but I believe he was forced to go against his intuition. He didn't know what he was doing. What makes life mean something is purpose, a goal, a battle, a struggle. Even if you don't win it. Even if, when you look back on the path you took to arrive to the end of that struggle, all you can see is blood on the tracks.
Chapter 2. John Lennon and Richard Nixon.
I think it's only human nature to be myopic. We see things how we want to see them. We remember things the way we thought they happened. So of course it's only natural that when you think about me and my presidency and my legacy, there are things that immediately come to your mind. There's a narrative. And in that narrative, I'm either a crook or a villain or some sort of metaphorical blight on the history of our great country.
Although we all think we're a little smarter than we actually are.
I'm an adjective now, Nixonian. And believe me when I tell you that resigning the office of the president was incredibly difficult. You can't begin to imagine how difficult it was. I felt like I had no purpose.
That's when life becomes almost unbearable.
If history is truly written by the victors, and I believe that it is, well, the victors are just as myopic as any of us. The victors don't remember the remarkable things that I was able to accomplish as president. The things my administration accomplished. We extended the Voting Rights Act. We signed the Clean Air Act into law and the Water Pollution Control Act. We established the Environmental Protection Agency, for crying out loud. We made diplomatic progress with Moscow and Beijing. We wanted to bring the Cold War to an end. We set up an Office of Consumer Affairs in the White House, expanded the National Park System, created OSHA, reduced the voting age to 18, and dramatically increased funding to the arts and public broadcasting. Not Kennedy, not Johnson, my administration. History has defined me, not as a progressive, but as a boogeyman. They've been calling me Tricky Dick for years, ever since the election in 1950 when I became a state senator. When I was president, I brought massive healthcare reform to the table.
A battle.
And you know what happened? The Democrats opposed it. I'm talking sweeping reform, the very kind of reform that the Democrats have been fighting for years. I gave it to them on a silver platter, but they didn't want it because it came from me, a Republican. And not just any Republican, but the Republican who had been beaten in the past by Kennedy and that many saw as a pariah. That's politics. And especially in politics, people put other people into these predefined boxes, and you can't ever change, because if you change, then you are betraying the confines of that little box, thereby betraying what has been defined as you. Now, maybe my own view of John Lennon was myopic.
I do not consider myself to be anything but an average person.
Maybe I put him in a box based on who or what I thought he was. But you must remember, this was a very turbulent time in America's history. The radical left was encouraging the masses to kidnap ambassadors, to hijack planes, to blow up buildings, as protest. So many planes were hijacked in the late 60s and early 70s that the Secret Service forbade my family from flying on any commercial airlines. And then that mess with the Weather Underground, making bombs in the basement of a village townhouse. One of those damn things went off and destroyed the building, all four stories. People think I was out of touch, but I was paying attention. I heard Lennon's song, Give Me Some Truth. He's fed up in that song. He called politicians psychotic, said we were the blind leading the blind. He enjoyed attacking me personally. Do you see the back cover of his album where it's a doctored photo of me and Mao dancing naked together? But that Give Me Some Truth song, that was a call to arms, I believe. John wanted to provoke people and get them fired up.
It may have looked like John Lennon believed in the courage of his convictions.
He wanted an uprising that was a clear and present danger to America, to me, and to my family. All of his songs from this period were calls to arms. If you think that Give Peace a Chance is a peaceful song, you need to wake up. That's that myopic thinking again. That is a song specifically intended to incite a riot, to get people mobilized, to get people marching en masse to a confrontation with the very people they elected. And the ironic thing is, that very few of these people who sang along with these songs and marched along in these protests, the ironic thing is that they don't even know what they were speaking out against.
Life in which an individual is forced to go against his intuition about what he thinks he ought to do.
They were just following a famous person down a street. Not just famous, but naive. This is a man who said that I, the president, should just declare peace, as if you could do such a thing. His fans, they all thought it was possible, so they followed him, and they would go wherever he would lead.
He didn't know what he was doing.
Because in 1972, John Lennon was no longer a songwriter in my eyes. He was playing the role of a Pied Piper in a cultural uprising, and that was a threat. John had become merely a tool of the radical leftist paramilitary movement, and that was dangerous. He wrote songs about John Sinclair and Angela Davis and Attica. He hung around Bobby Seale and Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. These were well-established threats to democracy, anti-Americans. Those men all used John as their megaphone to march their message up and down the streets of New York City, and then the streets of Washington, and then presumably down the streets of Miami, where myself and all the others in the Republican Party would be sitting ducks. It's all true. Hoover had John Lennon and his wife under surveillance in New York City. They were justified in their paranoia, just like I was justified in mine. They were followed. We planted agents in the audience every time he made a public appearance or played a concert.
Going to parties every night.
There's no evidence out there that we authorized the wiretapping of their telephones. But between you and me and the wall, I wouldn't be surprised if Hoover's men made sure a little authorization didn't stand between them and the intelligence they needed to collect. It was because of this surveillance that we were able to uncover a very troubling plot. Richard Helms, the head of the CIA, brought a memo to Hoover, and Hoover brought it to me. John Lennon wasn't planning a rock and roll tour in the traditional sense. He was plotting a direct route from New York to Miami, a route that directly followed my campaign trail, and then he was hatching a plot to disrupt the Republican National Convention in Miami at the end of that route in August.
Shattered experience.
We needed a strategic countermeasure. That's what Hoover said. And I trusted him, of course. He'd been director of the FBI for almost 50 years. And Hoover was intimately familiar with what Lennon had been doing for years, even back in 1969, when he and his wife released that unlistenable album with a filthy cover. The two of them, stark raving naked. A congressman sent an angry letter about such unnecessary filth to Hoover, and that's probably when the FBI opened a file. The congressman called it a vulgar display of garbage. Hoover sent some men to tail Lennon when he visited the States in 1970 and went to California. They were under strict direction to gather whatever evidence they could to prove that Lennon was engaged in violent anti-war demonstrations or narcotics.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
They hit the jackpot when they caught wind of the plan in 1972 to disrupt the Republican convention in Miami. Lennon put it together with help from Reuben Hoffman Sinclair, and Allen Ginsberg was there. And at the center of this plan was John Lennon, being used as a tool to sow discontent among youth.
But I believe he was forced to go against his intuition.
And now 12 million new voters who would be going to the polls since we reduced the voting age. John Lennon was not an American. He paid no taxes. But yet, he was here, in this country, spreading an anti-American message to millions of impressionable minds. That's what sent red flags up the chain of command all the way to me. A strategic countermeasure, Hoover said. The easiest thing was to deport John Lennon as soon as possible.
What makes life mean something is purpose.
John Lennon's status in this country was as a guest. We had made an exception for him to be here, to be with his wife for a brief amount of time. He wasn't eligible for a visa because of the drug convention back in England, the one where the drug squad found cannabis resin in his London flat back in 1968. But nevertheless, he'd been able to secure a 60-day visa with the help of his lawyers. We used that London drug conviction as a major reason why he should be told he had a month to leave the country. This was March of 1972. If Lennon did as he was told, he would be out of the country long before my campaign trail got to Miami, and therefore he would not be able to rally his fans and bring violence and dissent to the Republican National Convention. That was our strategic countermeasure.
Although we all think we're a little smarter than we actually are.
But Lennon had strategies of his own. He hired an immigration lawyer and fought tooth and nail to stay. His lawyer applied for permanent status for both John Lennon and his wife, that Yoko Ono. Well, she could get permanent status because she was the mother of an American child. So if we granted her residence and then denied Lennon, that same movement that he was mobilizing would accuse us of breaking up a family.
Not having anything to live for could be a shattering experience.
Yoko Ono sat in a witness chair in the hearing room at the Immigration and Naturalization Service building in Manhattan and said, and I quote, "You're asking me to choose between my child and my husband." And then she said, "I don't know if there's any mercy to plead for because this isn't a federal court. But if there is, I'd like it, please." I couldn't believe it. I was told this was a done deal, that removing John Lennon from the United States would be easy.
Forced to go against his intuition.
Consider it done. That's what they told me. And now we're stuck in this impasse. Lennon's lawyer kept buying him a little more time, and then a little more. How is it possible that he can get these little extra bits of time? I kept asking Hoover that question. And I wasn't getting the goddamn answer that I wanted. And Miami was approaching. I could only imagine how much angrier John Lennon was becoming, and how much his hatred of me and my administration had been exacerbated by our deportation efforts. And that he would funnel that anger into his so-called revolution at the upcoming convention. So I took matters into my own hands, which is what you have to do as president sometimes. Just like I did in 1952, when the papers called for me to abandon my run for vice president over what they perceived as some secret fund.
But in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent.
I went on live TV and got my base in my corner. But when I lost the 1960 presidential election to Kennedy, I didn't mope about it. I hit the road and hustled, and my efforts helped me get Republicans elected in droves. The House, the Senate, governors.
What makes life mean something is purpose.
It set me up to become president in 1968.
And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice.
But back in 1972, taking matters into my own hands when it was clear that deporting John Lennon was going to be harder than I thought, I bent the ear of a young White House staffer, a kid named Tom Houston. I asked him to look into this whole situation. The bomb makers, the dander getter uppers, the rabble rousers, and how someone as famous and influential as John Lennon fit into it all.
The unhappiest people in the world.
I asked Tom to come back with a plan for us to combat the approaching storm of resistance. Tom delivered. He may have delivered a little too much. I think he even scared Hoover. His plan called for widespread mail opening of known radicals, and something I've been told was referred to as black bag jobs, or breaking into residences to install taps and bugs. Again, on known radicals. Were these tactics illegal?
Well, I'm not a crook.
You're asking the wrong question. The question you should be asking is, what would you do to protect your country?
We'll be right back after this
word.
Now, I like music and musicians just fine. The great R&B artist James Brown played at my inauguration in 1969. He played a terrific song of his called Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, which, if I may be so bold, was perhaps one of the most culturally important songs played at a presidential inauguration ever. Because James Brown wanted to bring people together with his music. And I wanted to bring people together.
Purpose.
James Brown believed in what I was doing so much that he even endorsed me when I ran a second time. And then there was Elvis. Elvis came to see me at the White House in 1970. He told me that he was on my side, just like James Brown. Before he left, Elvis asked for a badge from the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Why the hell not? He was the king after all. Someone told me later that the only reason Elvis wanted the badge was because he thought it would give him carte blanche to carry guns and drugs with him wherever he went. I don't know if I believe that. Presley seemed like a decent fellow to me.
Although we all think we're a little smarter than we actually are.
John Lennon, on the other hand, did not. This is how John Lennon was different in my eyes from other musicians like James Brown and Elvis Presley. John Lennon was no longer a Beatle. He was no longer John Lennon the musician. As soon as he stepped onto American soil, he changed.
Forced to go against his intuition.
He became John Lennon the disruptor, and I was his target. Now, the intel about the Republican convention business wasn't the first time we had received information claiming that John Lennon was planning something. Jerry Rubin himself, when talking to the press about the concert, a bunch of them were going to stage at the Republican Party's presidential nominating convention in San Diego. That was the summer of 71. We didn't have to tap any phones or pull any black bag jobs to get that info. Jerry Rubin just went ahead and told whoever wanted to listen.
Talking too much, thinking too little.
So Hoover ran with that information and became increasingly concerned that whatever it was that they were planning was more than a concert. They wanted chaos.
Even if you don't win it.
They wanted me out. That was for damn sure. They wanted to topple the system as we knew it, as we still know it, today. It was either the Yippies, or the Black Panthers, or the White Panthers, or just some hodgepodge, all of the above. Misguided, anti-war radicals. And John was part of that mix. Whatever we did to monitor John Lennon's activity, the people he associated with, the meetings he attended, the ideas he sought to disseminate, we did it all because we thought we had to. And if it made him nervous, if it made him paranoid and caused him to rethink what he was doing and saying, well, good, so be it. First, Lennon thought he heard clicking sounds on his phone line. Then he thought he heard footsteps walking behind him on the sidewalk. And then he couldn't look at any regular person the same way anymore. Mailmen, dog walkers, cab drivers, Nannies pushing babies through Manhattan in a stroller. They all looked suspect to him. He couldn't trust anyone. He couldn't turn his back on strangers. Every phone call, every knock on the door, every passing good morning pleasantry.
That's when life becomes almost unbearable.
Pretty soon, he couldn't take it anymore. And then, partly through the duress we put upon him, John Lennon came to his senses. He looked at all these co-conspirators in their eyes. What in the hell were they thinking? Didn't they remember Chicago in 1968, the Democratic National Convention? The National Guard and the cops and billy clubs and tear gas? Is that what they wanted? And if, God forbid, they were successful, if this ragtag group of violent insurrectionists got what they wanted and toppled the system, then what? What would they replace it with? What was the point of all this?
He didn't know what he was doing.
Now, Lennon's decision to bow out of it all, first to abandon the San Diego plot, and then abandon the Miami plot. Certainly, he made that decision with the safety of his own life on his mind. I think these other people, Rubin, Seale, Sinclair, they all lived this life from the get-go.
The unhappiest people in the world.
A life of surveillance and danger, and the edge never being edgy enough. And it was a new territory for Lennon, and let's face it, when it came down to it, what we exposed in John Lennon is that he was no revolutionary. He was no activist. He was a dilettante.
He was forced to go against his intuition.
He even said so before he died. He did it out of guilt. Guilt for being rich and famous. Guilt for not being a man of the people, as he liked to pretend. He allowed himself to be manipulated by people whose purpose in life was to manipulate powerful people in order to get what they wanted.
Talking too much, thinking too little.
Well, they never got what they wanted. But I got what I wanted. First, we defused John Lennon's influence.
A battle.
And then, on Tuesday, November 7th, 1972, I was re-elected President of the United States over George McGovern.
A struggle.
And you know what? There was no surge of young voters between ages 18 and 21. In fact, it was the lowest voter turnout in over 20 years.
Although we all think we're a little smarter than we actually are.
And the Americans that did go to the polls, they re-elected me in a landslide.
A gold.
I won 49 states. McGovern got one state, Massachusetts. The silent majority had spoken up, and they had spoken up for me. John Lennon's America was not America. The Yippies' America was not America. The peace and love movement was a blip on the radar. There was no revolution. There was just purpose.
What makes life mean something is purpose.
And it wasn't John Lennon's. It was America's. It was mine.
August 8th, 1974, 9:01 p.m. Eastern Time, the White House. Richard Nixon felt the heat of the excess lighting that had been hauled into the Oval Office for the purpose of the television cameras. The lights, the camera, the crew, it all seemed a bit overkill to him. Less was more in his opinion, but what was actually occupying Nixon's mind in those final seconds leading up to when the cameraman gave him the thumbs up and the feed went live into the homes of millions of his fellow Americans was that he would sweat like a pig. That the sweaty image of a disgraced president throwing in the towel live on national TV would give his critics even more ammunition with which they could continue to assassinate his character. But at least it wasn't as bad as the debates with Jack Kennedy. Nixon had that going for him. That was 1960, election year, the first time Nixon ran for president. Kennedy didn't need to do much to win that first debate. Nixon refused to wear the customary makeup one wears when one appears on television. He was unshaven and haggard. Nixon looked so bad that night that his own mother called him after the debate was over to ask if he was ill. Nixon had learned from that mistake, a mistake that cost him the election by a hair. He didn't contest the election. He did the honorable thing, which was to concede to his opponent, Jack Kennedy, the man with the hair and the smile. And then Nixon did the honorable thing again when he formally certified Kennedy's election in front of Congress on January 6th of the following year. After all, Nixon was vice president under outgoing President Eisenhower, and so at that moment, that was his role, his purpose. Now, in 1974, staring into the reflection of a camera's lens, Nixon had a new purpose, and once again, it was the honorable thing. Richard Nixon stared straight into the glassy abyss of the camera lens and resigned the office of the President of the United States. Nixon's resignation, of course, was due to his involvement in an attempted cover-up of a 1972 break-in to the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate office building in Washington, D.C. It was Tom Houston's black bag job strategy gone wild. The ensuing investigation would indict 69 people and convict 48, many of them in high positions of power within Nixon's administration. And as if that wasn't enough, in the midst of the Watergate scandal, Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, was embroiled in a controversy of his own. When it was revealed that Agnew had been taking cash bribes from engineering and construction firms for more than 10 years, including the years he served as vice president, he resigned ahead of Nixon in order to avoid his own impeachment. Nixon and Agnew were both left to contemplate whether or not they had any purpose left in life. In Los Angeles, earlier in the afternoon of August 8, 1974, John Lennon held up a copy of the late edition of the Los Angeles Times for a photographer on the street. "Nixon quits," read the headline. "We'll explain decision on TV tonight." In the photo, John, who was still embroiled in a legal battle over the status of his U.S. citizenship, looked like a weight had been lifted off his shoulders, like he had won the fight. Nixon's re-election in 72 had served as a major turning point in John's political activism. When John heard the news that day, oh boy, it nearly killed him. He wondered if his attempts to mobilize the youth vote were in vain. The bed-ins, the rallies, the marches, the songs. Didn't the American public know that war was over if they wanted it? Did they not want it? In 1972, Nixon had won and John was defeated. John drank from a tequila bottle until the sun came up that night, and then, in front of Yoko and a whole bunch of party guests, he took a fellow partygoer to bed for a shag. All was lost, it seemed. He wondered if revolution was nothing but a catchy pop song. John thought back to San Diego and Miami. Maybe he should have followed through with the plan to violently disrupt the Republican Party. Maybe that would have made a difference. Maybe violence had been the answer all along. Maybe he'd join the Weather Underground, go build bombs in a basement in Lower Manhattan, fight fire with fire, or do what Eldridge Cleaver, the Black Panther, suggested in Off the Pig. Or maybe he'd just say fuck it and just disappear. He'd go somewhere else entirely, and keep up with a diet of tequila and cocaine and forget about revolution for good. People would look at him and point and say with equal parts disgust and disbelief, "That's John Lennon?" He wouldn't let the comments bother him. He wouldn't let anything bother him anymore. Because what did it even matter anymore? In a world where Nixon was elected twice, there was no hope, just nihilism. It made no difference what John did, how hard he tried, what he said, how he sang. Things didn't seem to be getting better all the time. There was always a mess, it was always a slog, and there didn't seem to be anything anyone could do about the carnage left in society's wake. Life just barreled forward, fast, out of control, leaving behind so much blood on the tracks. All right, everybody, thanks for listening to Blood on the Tracks. If you like what you hear, be sure to find and follow Blood on the Tracks on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. On this season 2 of Blood on the Tracks, we'll be releasing 10 episodes on the incredible life of John Lennon, with a new episode every Thursday. You can also binge all 10 episodes of season 1 on the insane story of the notorious record producer Phil Spector. Right now, it's available wherever you get your podcasts. This episode of Blood on the Tracks was written by Zeth Lundy and hosted and executive produced by me, Jake Brennan. Also executive produced by Brady Sadler. Story and copy editing by Pat Healy.
This episode was mixed by Colin Fleming. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. This episode featured Dennis Brennan as Richard Nixon. Blood on the Tracks is produced by Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the Blood on the Tracks series page. If you want to chat about this show or hear more about the other shows we're making at Double Elvis, tap in on Instagram at Double Elvis, on Twitter at Double Elvis FM, and now on Twitch, where we're streaming 3 days a week at twitch.tv/Double Elvis Podcasts. And finally, be sure to check out Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I also host. Disgraceland is available only on the free Amazon Music app. To hear tons of insane stories about your favorite musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly, go to amazon.com/Disgraceland, or if you have an Echo device, just say, Alexa, play the Disgraceland podcast. Rock along.
Bye, crazy. Oh, dang it.